Quinn, may please be seated. Again, on behalf of the whole court, I apologize for the time delay. A couple of our members, a lot of times when we're down here from Carson City, we have speaking engagements at different places and court education programs, and we did have to, had some of our justices say that this morning they were kind of delayed in traffic coming back. So again, our apologies. Okay, let's go ahead and call our first case this morning, case number 57109, Connor versus the State of Nevada. Mr. Brooks on behalf of Mr. Connor and Ms. Weckerly on behalf of the state. Mr. Brooks, did you wish to reserve, this is a 60-minute argument, did you wish to reserve any portion of your 30 minutes?
Yes, I asked to reserve 10 minutes in rebuttal, please.
Very well. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Howard Brooks. I'm a Clark County public defender, and I represent Charles Connor. A jury convicted Mr. Connor of first-degree murder and two counts of sexual assault. The jury sentenced him to death. Less than a month ago, I appeared before this court, and I argued in a death penalty case that the state violated the Equal Protection Clause in Batson v. Kentucky by using peremptory challenges to remove minorities from a jury. We have the same issue in this case. The state used six of their nine peremptory challenges to remove minorities in this case. I'm going to talk in detail about two of the strikes.
Could you go through the prongs, though? I think it's important that this court to hear your views on the prongs, and as this record, we do the same thing as the prongs as set forth in Batson and our case law.
You mean the procedure for Batson?
Yes. Well, we call it the prongs, I think is what we call it.
Basically, it's very simple. The defense objects and has to make a prima facie case of discrimination.
How do you do that?
There are four possible areas to explore in doing that. First of all, we have the initial strike of a minority. Then we have the potential that the discussion on the record during the dire does not give any reason for a strike. And if there is no reason, no apparent reason from the discussion in court, then one is left with the only possibility left, which is a discrimination. Another possibility is, of course, a pattern of discrimination where the state has used more than one strike against minorities. Here, the attorney said, Judge, they've used six of nine peremptories against minorities. So here, clearly, they had that. We also have the possibility, of course, in a perfect world, of doing a comparative juror analysis. I submit to you, I can't do it in the trial court. I can do it on appeal when I have the transcripts. I'm just not that smart to do it immediately on my feet. And then, of course, there could be blatant statements that would suggest discrimination. So that's what we're generally going here. But here, the attorney said the state has used six of nine peremptories to strike minorities. So we have a pattern, and that's what the attorney relied upon. Now, once the initial prima facie case is made, the burden shifts to the state, and the state must present a race-neutral reason. And then there should be a discussion or an argument among the parties regarding whether or not that is pretextual. In this case, during the voir dire, we have Troy Anderson, juror 157. He answered all questions posed by the state and the defense. He had a background in military, law enforcement, and corrections. Nothing in his questionnaire answers indicated any problem with the death penalty. When asked, what are your current feelings about the death penalty, Anderson wrote, I agree that the punishment should fit the crime. When the prosecutor asked him, if you serve as a juror, could you vote to impose the ultimate punishment, death? He answered, yes, sir, I could. Nothing in the questionnaire, nothing in his in-court answer suggested any problem with this man serving on the jury. So the state struck Mr. Anderson, and the district court required the state to provide a race-neutral reason after the defense objected pursuant to Batson. The prosecutor initially told the judge that the juror had one of two problems. One, the juror could not imagine a circumstance where the death penalty could be imposed. Or the juror said in his questionnaire that he did not consider the death penalty, but then changed his mind in his in-court answers. Now, that's what the prosecutor said. And I submit to you that if we look at the record, we find that neither of those statements are true. If you look at volume B, 225, and if you look at the in-court questioning at 1425 to 1440, there is no support for those claims. Later, the court asked the state to restate their reasons for Mr. Anderson. And the state said the following. If Mr. Anderson served on the jury, they were concerned that because of his law enforcement experience, he would impose himself as an expert on the prison system and rehabilitation and things of that nature. Now, first of all, this is a completely different reason given by the state at first. Second, they are now assuming that this man of a law enforcement background would disregard the rules, would disregard the court's instructions, and would impose himself as an expert in the jury room. We can test the legitimacy of a race-neutral reason by looking at whether the state questioned the juror about this concern when they had the chance to do so. If we look at pages 1425 to 1440, we find the state asked Mr. Anderson 40 questions. 40 questions. And not one question was asked about whether he would impose himself on the other jurors or pretend to be an expert or exert some undue influence. Not one question. Quote, the state's failure to engage in any meaningful or dire examination on a subject the state alleges it is concerned about is evidence suggesting that the explanation is a sham and a pretext for discrimination. End quote. That's from the United States Supreme Court in Miller L. v. Dredd. I've done 43 trials, jury trials in this county. I have never once encountered a prosecutor who expressed concern about a law enforcement background person imposing himself as an expert in the jury room. I just never heard of that. The fact is the state had ample opportunity here to give a race-neutral reason, and they failed to do so. Something very similar happened to juror Kathy Clark, juror 150, a black female. With Ms. Clark, she served on several civil and criminal juries in Clark County. She was a foreman of a jury. She served on the grand jury. Surely the state would like that. She was a dealer in Kissimmee for 27 years. When asked about the death penalty in the questionnaire, she said, I have no feelings about it. Each case is different. She said she could consider all three of possibilities, including death. When asked whether the death penalty was imposed too seldom or too often, she wrote, too seldom. Then she marked it out and wrote, no opinion. She agreed with the statement, the death penalty is appropriate in some murder cases, but not others.
Mr. Brooks, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but which number juror? I haven't charted.
This is juror 150, Kathy.
150, thank you, I'm sorry.
Yes, clearly. The state eliminated Ms. Clark. And again, they offered the same reasons they had applied for Mr. Anderson. Number one, she could not imagine a circumstance where the death penalty could be imposed. Or, she said one thing in her questionnaire and then changed her mind in court. Once again, the record does not support this. Both statements are false. Later, the state gave an additional reason that Ms. Clark said she had never heard of a situation where the death penalty was appropriate. Now, I will tell you bluntly, that is a gross distortion of the record. Here is what Ms. Clark said, quote, sorry, Ms. Wackerly said first, do you think there could be a situation where you think the death penalty would be the appropriate punishment? Ms. Clark, I'm sure, yes, there could be, end quote. I urge this court to look at page 1414 in the record and look at the complete questioning of Ms. Clark. And I submit to you, the state reason here is completely without a factual foundation. She would have been an excellent juror. Under these circumstances, we have two minority jurors where the state offered pretextual reasons for their exclusion. We have two Batson violations. And pursuant to Diabongo v. State, we know that this goes to the fundamental integrity of our trials. It's structural error. It requires reversal. I want to comment briefly on the four other minorities excused by the state.
Mr. Brooks, could you focus specifically on Juror 11?
Which one is Juror 11?
Hispanic-American. There was a dispute over him raising his hand and responding to a question with regard to the death penalty.
Let me say this, Justice Hardesty, if you'll allow me. First of all, Juror 806 and 62. I think the state's exclusion was completely appropriate. So then we have the two other jurors, which includes Juror 11. Now, I'll be quite frank with you. This is Jurors Rico and Cabreras. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, the record on those two jurors is extremely confusing. And I can't make a coherent and clear-cut argument on those two jurors like I can for the two jurors I just talked about.
Okay.
So, I mean, I'm not going to try to do that on those two jurors because it's just too confusing.
Okay.
Another topic familiar to this court, which I would like to raise today, concerns the penalty phase.
Can you move off the Batson challenges? If you were to write an opinion saying there was a Batson issue in this case, that invalidated the conviction as to 157 and 150, you would have to find that the district court abused its discretion, is that right? Or is it a clearly erroneous finding of fact on lack of pretext? What standard of review would you state is applicable, and how do you contend that review is met here? Do you follow?
I believe that we have an odd situation involving Batson. The truth of the matter is, in the way Batson actually works, the district courts do not go into the record at the way, in an ideal world, it should be done. In this circumstance, the district court did not make the examination of whether these reasons were truly pretextual. And I think that we have to say that the court had a duty to do more, and that what the court did not work. And I think that here, with the lack of a race-neutral reason that works, we have to go with the integrity of the process.
So you would say really no deference to the district court because the district court abdicated its responsibility to make the findings that permit intelligent appellate review? Is that what you're saying?
Excellent reason, yes.
Okay.
Going to the penalty phase, the jury has an awesome responsibility. We have aggravating circumstances and mitigating circumstances. And the state has to look at these, consider them, and render a verdict which is reliable. The U.S. Supreme Court has held that the Eighth Amendment requires the jury to look at and give effect to mitigating circumstances. And as we all know, mitigating evidence is any evidence which one juror may consider in deciding to give a defendant a sentence less than death. In Tenard v. Dredge, the U.S. Supreme Court said there need not be any nexus between mitigating evidence and the crime. means is something can be mitigating that simply appeals to one juror. If a defendant is good-looking or charming, that can be mitigated. If the defendant is a model prisoner, that can be mitigated. In this case, the defense proposed 36 mitigating circumstances, but the jury only found 9. A possible reason why the jury rejected 27 proposed mitigators could be from the jury instruction which was given in this case. And I will quote part of it. It says, mitigating circumstances are those factors which extenuate or reduce the defendant's moral culpability. We know that culpability is blameworthiness. If we're talking about blame, then we're talking about the crime. The essence of this instruction is that a circumstance can only be mitigating if it reduces the defendant's blameworthiness for the crime. In other words, there must be a nexus. And that nexus requirement has been rejected repeatedly by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Where does the moral culpability instruction come from?
Well, Justice Cherry, you asked that question a month ago, and I don't know the answer, but I will tell you this. After the John Watson appeal in January, death penalty appeal, the state filed a notice of supplemental authorities and said the U.S. Supreme Court adopted this instruction in Kansas v. Marsh. That statement is untrue. The instruction was mentioned in passing in Kansas v. Marsh. It was not challenged. It was not analyzed. It was not adopted or approved.
And you traversed the supplemental authority on that basis, correct, in Watson? So you're not arguing outside the Watson
race? Yes.
Okay.
So, similarly, the state has argued previously that Thomas v. State, a 2001 Nevada case, adopts the instruction. Again, in Thomas, this court mentioned the instruction, but there was no analysis, no approval. It was simply mentioned in passing. What we know is this. The jury was improperly instructed. We don't know if one juror, six jurors, or all 12 jurors used that instruction in an improper way. What we do know is that the death verdict in this case is less reliable as a result of that instruction. And I submit to you, the death sentence must be vacated based on that instruction error.
Mr. Brooks, let me ask you on one other issue. I know the court has some concern about. On the autopsy report, the testimony regarding quoting and if you maybe talk about that, and if it's error, is it plain error, and all, and corpus delicti implications.
Mr. Chief.
Yes,
just before we leave this area, if you could comment in terms of the other instructions in the packet. There was an issue as to instruction 8 and instruction 13, whether they have any effect as to instruction 12, which you talked about.
I apologize, Justice Douglas. I didn't raise those two instructions.
Well, you didn't raise them as being deficient, but the question is they're in the packet, and when you look at them, do they affect instruction number 12 in terms of their guidance to the jury in terms of culpability and other phrases that you're saying?
I apologize.
Because we take the instruction packet as a whole and not just take one out of sequence.
Yes, I understand.
That's my
that.
Concern.
Unfortunately, I didn't brief that, but didn't prepare for it. I'm not prepared to address it, but I apologize.
Okay.
Very well. As we all know, out-of-court statements are generally considered inadmissible hearsay. The U.S. Supreme Court strengthened that rule in Crawford v. Washington by holding that certain forms of hearsay constitute violations of confrontation clause. Crawford said that some statements are testimonial in nature, meaning that objective people can perceive that they were prepared with an anticipation that would be used in a court proceeding. If evidence is testimonial, then introducing that evidence violates the Confrontation Clause unless the defense has the opportunity to cross-examine the out-of-court declarant. We all know that when a person is murdered, the coroner does an autopsy, and an autopsy report is prepared. We all know that coroners work closely with the police. Police are often present at autopsies. Coroners also work very closely with the DAs. And we all know that the autopsy report, with its discussion of the cause of death and other related findings, is extremely important in murder cases. So the U.S. Supreme Court recently considered how Crawford applied to a situation applicable to this case. What happens when a forensic analyst prepares a report detailing blood alcohol level of the criminal defendant, and then they take a different forensic analyst and that person introduces that at trial? The Supreme Court said that's a Crawford violation. That's exactly what happened in this case. What we have is we have a Dr. Clark preparing an autopsy report, and we have a different doctor presenting those results.
Weren't some of the results part of Dr. Olson's independent opinion?
The state claims that Dr. Olson did their own independent investigation, but I dispute that. Dr. Olson did not do an autopsy. Dr. Olson simply reviewed this report, looked at the photographs, and then miraculously came into court and parroted the findings of Dr. Clark.
Reviewing photographs, why can't she make an independent determination herself?
Well, I would certainly agree that an independent investigation might be fine if the person had some independent findings. There were no independent findings. This was simply a parroting of the report of Dr. Clark. And the key issue, which Justice Gibbons alluded to, the fact is we didn't object to it. So the question is whether it's plain error. I submit to you it has to be plain error for a very simple reason. The key question in plain error analysis is whether the error was clear and whether it affected the outcome of the case. One count in this case was sexual assault, vaginal sexual assault. There is virtually no evidence that that was not consensual. But the report has a statement, probable rape. The coroner did not find that there was any trauma to the vagina. There's nothing in the report that suggests probable rape, but he says that.
Well, but the circumstances of the crime scene with the cut-off clothing and so forth.
I believe that if we get into the entire deal here, the circumstances are relatively clear.
I mean, the anal sex, maybe, but the vaginal one is much harder sell for you.
I respectfully, I disagree. We have two very drunk people. They go back to the apartment. They engage in consensual vaginal sex. Then he wants to have anal sex. That's when he takes the hammer, beats her, kills her. Then he cuts the gloves off, and he proceeds to have anal sex with the dead woman.
So you accept that the anal sex conviction is sound?
No.
Okay, you contest both.
She was dead when the anal sex occurred. What happened here is we had consensual vaginal sex. This is two very drunk people. We have consensual vaginal sex. Then we have her kill her with a hammer. Then we have the sex with a dead person, which is a different crime than what was alleged in this case. Can you turn it over to Ms. Wacker?
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. You have about 6.5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Wacker, on behalf of the state.
Justices, my name is Pam Weckerly. I was one of the trial prosecutors in the case, and I actually remember this case very vividly. If it's okay with the court, I'd like to start with the Batson issue.
And could you go through it as to what your obligations are as a prosecutor as opposed to what Mr. Brooks presented as a defense attorney.
Certainly. I'd just also like to start with telling this court that the deliberating jury in this case was 11 women and one man who actually returned the verdicts in this case, which is sort of unusual in our jury system.
Were there any minority jurors?
Yes, there were minority jurors who were seated in the panel. And I think that when you go through a jury selection process, you get the big panel at the beginning, and some of the people have differing opinions about the death penalty. Now, it could be by happenstance that a lot of women don't want to impose in your panel the death penalty. So then you end up kicking or using your preempts on more female jurors. It could be that more minority jurors in your big panel don't want to impose the death penalty or are weak on penalty. And then the pattern will be, if you're using reasonable reasons based on penalty, that you end up using more of your preempts on minority jurors. Now, I know Mr. Brooks discussed the three-step process that you have to go through when doing a Batson analysis. However, because he did only discuss two of our challenges, but there was an allegation that six of our nine challenges were used on minority jurors, and so I'd like to discuss each challenge that we used on a minority prospective panelist.
Ms. Rippley, as you do so, would you please make a moment or a note in your argument to please address the inconsistencies that Mr. Brooks has pointed out with respect to the challenges made and the reason given, and the inconsistency within that?
Sure.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you as well. I'm not sure that I fully grasp what you just said in your introduction. Are you saying that you believe minorities are less likely to be so-called death?
No. I'm saying when you do a capital murder, they send out a questionnaire to 150 prospective jurors. It could be that you get a bunch of Caucasian people who don't want to impose the death penalty within that 150. And then you end up using a lot of your peremptory challenges on Caucasians. It could be that your panelists, a lot of teachers or a lot of social workers, you're confined to that group, and there's not a science to it. You get a big panel, and those people's opinions are their opinion. And if we're...
So you're saying that there was a disproportionate number of minorities preempted in this case because the population in that group was more skeptical of imposing death in this case?
Well, we went through a lot of jurors, and every single juror that we used a peremptory challenge on, we viewed as someone who could not impose the death penalty or would be weak on imposing
it. What about juror 157?
Mr. Anderson, correct? In volume 6 on page 1443, Mr. Anderson noted or said in an answer that the death penalty is the same as prison, in his opinion. He said that prison, in his view, is the worst punishment. He said in his experience as a prison guard that he knows the criminal justice system, there's nothing black and white. He also mentioned in his questioning that in prison, you're literally fighting for your life every day. He also mentioned in his questioning that in prison, it's a difficult circumstance. It's difficult to live in that environment because you could be raped. He said in his questioning, with the death penalty, there's no chance at redemption, and I believe everybody should have a chance at redemption. Now, when we hear those answers, we view that as someone who might be reticent to impose the death penalty. Ms. Clark said...
Before you leave 157, Mr. Brooks made the point with respect to that juror that when pressed, the state offered a second race-neutral reason, that being his police or prison background, and then offered the suggestion that that's passing strange for the DA to be challenging a juror based on police or custodial experience. Could you comment on that, and also Miller L., and whether or not, in your estimation, you did adequately question this juror on the second of the race-neutral reasons?
The second reason, I remember how this juror was in the actual jury selection process. He was nodding his head. He was answering questions for
us. Is that on the record?
Yes. It's in our explanation. And okay. Certainly that wasn't challenged by Judge Kadish, who got to observe that behavior, or by the defense once we explained that. He was nodding his head. He was answering questions for other jurors. He was going to be sort of the resident expert on what it's going to be like if someone were to go to prison. Now, if we're trying to seek the death penalty, and this juror is saying that being in prison is worse, and being in prison you may be raped, and being in prison is fighting for your life every day, that causes us concern about whether this juror is someone that we think can impose the death penalty, given his experience, given his behavior, which we put in the record, about being sort of a dominant personality. There's no question in our mind that this individual is going to be a force in the deliberation room. And he knows more than everybody else about prison. And so that is a concern to us, whether he would be someone who could vote for the death penalty or someone who is going to say, well, look, prison is so bad, you may be raped there, you have to fight for your life every day. Those are race-neutral reasons in order to excuse the juror.
The theory being he would say, life in prison is worse than death?
Okay. Exactly. With regard to Ms. Clark, she said she had no vote, and this is volume 6, and her questioning is at page 1413. She said she had no feelings about the death penalty. When asked if she had heard of a case where she thought the death penalty was proper, she said, I don't really know of any cases like, you know, where I said, oh, they should get the death penalty, and that's at page 1414. Now, she said there could be a situation where she could envision one, but she couldn't come up with one in the selection process. And what's interesting to me is in the next part of the brief on behalf of the defendant, they say that the district court erred in not granting a challenge to three jurors. Those three jurors were Stofa, Howard, and Ann Galante. And the reason that Mr. Brooks offered why that was error is because none of those three jurors could envision a situation where they would impose a life with sentence or a life without sentence as opposed to the death penalty. And Judge Kadish denied the four-cause challenge. And it's interesting to me that qualifies for them not being able to envision a particular punishment. That should qualify as a four-cause challenge. But when we apply it to another juror, we're faced with a Batson challenge. That same standard about whether they can envision a death sentence or whether they can envision a life sentence. They're suggesting if you cannot envision a life sentence, that should be a four-cause challenge. But when we apply that standard about whether someone can envision a death sentence, and we kick a juror who can't, that's a pretextual reason, or that's not a race-neutral reason. That seems inconsistent to me. I think Judge Kadish made the correct ruling in all of these situations where they gave the possibility you didn't get your four-cause challenge, but that certainly doesn't rise to the level of us being racially discriminatory or giving pretextual reasons. It's the same on both sides.
Ms. Wickerly, there's been a lot of discussion here about the pretextual reasons, but could you address the first step in a Batson analysis? This record looks rather weak to me on this subject, but the first step is the opponent of the peremptory challenge must make out a prima facie case of discrimination. Mr. Brooks begins his argument by saying that the striking of six jurors satisfies that requirement. Could you comment on his view of this subject, and perhaps in addition, what in the record supports the satisfaction of the first step by the defense?
In my opinion, they didn't satisfy the first step, but the way the trial court kind of went through the process at the end of the day is she kind of skipped that step and made us go through each individual juror and give our reason for why we used the...
This isn't the first case where that's happened. There seems to be a repeated instance, Watson, other cases here that we see on appeal where this first step is ignored or disregarded or overlooked or however you want to phrase it. But it does raise an interesting question. What happens when the first step isn't addressed? The state doesn't comment on it either. Should it be treated as waived in that instance? Did you say anything?
We did not, not in this case.
So is the first step in this case waived by you?
Well, I don't think it should be waived, and particularly in this case where Mr. Brooks says there's a pattern, and he says 6 of 9 jurors who were, we used our preempts on, were minorities, but then when he argues, he only focuses on 2 and says the other 4 were legitimate. So, I mean, how does that establish a pattern?
Well, he says that the other 4 on pretext, at least 2, the record is confusing, the other 2 he elects not to argue. But on the first step, if the state sits silent and says, you haven't offered any explanation for this, do you waive, and should this court find that?
I don't think that that should count as our waiver because that's the initial burden of the opponent of
this. So in the same way that there's some level of criticism about the defense not adequately opposing a pretextual explanation, and that has occurred in this case, you've even argued that.
Right.
How does this court review these Batson challenges when the prosecution doesn't do its job in focusing on the first step, and then we're supposed to treat the defense in some different way when we're evaluating pretext? It seems to me that this whole Batson area requires a significant level of difference of approach to follow the law by both sides.
I agree with you, and I can tell you from my experience doing many trials that the trial judges all approach it differently.
Mm-hmm.
But what I will say is, by and large, the rule or the sort of practice is, if we strike a single minority juror or panelist, the court immediately, or you know, once we do the strike, will ask us what our race-neutral reason is without kind of addressing step one. And this isn't an excuse, but the reality is those trial judges, they want to get rid of the other jurors, seat the panel, and get going. So we certainly, I guess to our peril, don't always make the best records we should.
But under the law, this first step is more than an academic question.
It is.
And so let me ask you this. In the context of an opinion that would evaluate a Batson question, what must the defense demonstrate, in your view, to satisfy step one?
I listened to, I think it was the Watson argument, and I think Justice Cherry talked about that. I think it's possible that you could demonstrate a prima facie case of discrimination with a single strike, provided you had a juror that answered questions that raised, you know, no issues. I think you could also establish a prima facie case if you had a minority juror answer questions identically to a non-minority juror, and the non-minority was kept on the panel and a minority juror was released from the panel. I think that could establish a prima facie case.
So why couldn't the striking of 6 out of 9 satisfy a prima facie case?
I think in our situation, all of them are clearly consistently being stricken for the same reason. We struck everybody who we thought wouldn't impose the difference.
Again, I'm talking about prima facie, explanation. Why can the defense say, look, whether it's one juror or in this case 6 out of 9
sure.
are minority, that's prima facie, now we get to step 2.
I don't know if that establishes prima facie if the sitting trial judge who's observing the whole process and watching the questioning and watching the, honestly, the facial reactions, the body language, mm-hmm. the whole thing, they're in a different position respectfully than a reviewing court.
Sure.
I think it could in some instances maybe establish the prima facie case. But if the reviewing judge the trial judge is not seeing that, then I think simply adding up numbers isn't a genuine examination of whether they made their prima facie case. Simply counting people up identifying people based on how they look in court, I think that's a real artificial way of examining whether a truly prima facie case has been made. And respectfully, I think you have to defer to the trial judge who's sitting there observing the whole process and seeing how the lawyers are treating different prospective jurors.
You wouldn't give deference, though, when there are no findings, would you?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, probably not. But in this particular case, I don't think it rises to the level of that type of situation.
And my question is almost a follow-up. In fact, if we are to give deference to the trial judge's observation in the courtroom, then shouldn't that become part of the record so that we do have something as a reviewing court to understand what their basis was?
Yes, and when I reread the sort of the end of the jury selection day in this particular trial, Judge Kudish went through the process with us generally. Then we went through the specific jurors. And she actually said at the very end of the day, I reviewed my notes, I reviewed all of the peremptory challenger and challenge people's questionnaires, and based on that review and what I've observed or what I saw in court, that she found that we were not preempting jurors on a discriminatory basis. Now, that may not be as complete a record as the court would like, and I certainly understand that. But she did, at the end of the day, go through and explain that she had done her own analysis of both the questionnaires and the questioning and our reasons.
Yeah, it means subjective because we don't know what she observed.
That's true. But, I mean, she did sit there, through the whole process and was able to make observations. I agree with you, though, that they're not certainly noted in the record.
Of the 12 jurors at the liberty, you said 11 were women and one was a man. What about the minority breakdown? Was there an African-American in the 12, or was there a Hispanic?
I can't recall. I would note, though, Justice Jerry, that the defense did kick two African-American women that we passed for cause, and that was juror 147, and she's at volume 6 at page 1386. She certainly answered all the questions correctly and wasn't challenged for cause. There was another lady, juror number 218, she's in volume 7 at page 1623. Again, no challenge for cause. She actually had a father who was in custody. And so, I can't remember, honestly, what the makeup was, but there were minorities on the panel. What was sort of unusual in this case, in my experience, was having a jury of nearly all women.
Have you ever had a judge sustain a Batson challenge? In your experience as a prosecutor?
I have heard of it. I have personally not had that sustained against me.
I never saw it either.
I want to just pursue step one again.
Sure.
Because it is perplexing. I listened to Mr. Brooks, and he outlined four ways in which he believes step one can be surmounted. And you agree with him, comparative juror analysis, and really no reason at all is evident on the record for the strike, and the juror is a minority. The third one he listed was pattern, which is to say, a disproportionate number, at least, and I may be misinterpreting what he said, but as I took it, a disproportionate number of the strikes are leveled against minorities. And you kind of equivocated in answer to Justice Hardesty's questions on that. As a prima facie case, which is elemental, I'm not so sure that that's where the district judge's discretion and findings kicks in. And I wanted you to address, in the context of pattern, why you think the district judge's observational powers should be credited in assessing whether step one has been met. I mean, it seems to me that if there is a pattern and, six of nine of the strikes are minorities and the jury pool as a whole had only, some very small percentage of minorities, so side to side, it looks disproportionate. Why wouldn't that be a prima facie case sufficient to just shift the burden?
I mean, I guess that could be. I don't think there's a lot of case law defining
but
that.
There isn't, but I'm...
But I guess I question whether, a pattern of what? I mean, a pattern of who they randomly picked and sat with us, and maybe this person answered questions one way or another.
So you have a pool of 100, say, 10 are minorities, and there are 15 strikes, and of those strikes, 8 went to the minorities, so fully 50% of a population that, judged by the whole, is only 10%, was stricken. And my math is probably off here, but just bear with me.
Sure.
On a prima facie case, if pattern is one of the ways in which to meet that burden, and it's not a big burden, I mean, it's enough to shift and get a race-neutral reason, why wouldn't that be enough?
I guess it could be. I mean, this court could decide that is enough, but in my opinion, there should be a little bit more of a sort of qualitative analysis to what's going on. And I know it's difficult, and I know it's an important issue, but I can't stress how, when it's occurring and when you're picking juries, it's really dynamic. And I feel almost offended that there's an assumption that we're practices. And I can tell you that there are so many intangible things that you're trying to observe, and sometimes we're wrong. You could be wrong about a juror. I've certainly sat jurors that, you know, that were a mistake to seat. But when you're leveling that kind of charge, I would just hope it's more than a superficial count. At least,
right.
I understand that what you're saying is that's the first step, and then it would just shift.
Exactly. So, I mean, in Breyer, for example, he says you're really converting this into a for-cause justification.
Right.
And I'm not sure that's not right, but it's just troubling. It would really help us if we had better records.
I agree with you, and I am.
And I appreciate the heat of the battle. It's just very difficult.
I am guilty of not making a great record.
Ms. Whitehead, and I think the point, maybe both you and Mr. Brooks would agree, maybe we should be doing an opinion with a little more expansive explanation on these, because this is inconsistent application by the various district judges, so we can have a specific way to instruct them how to do this in the future and to help both the defense and the state make the proper records.
I agree, because there is sort of a misunderstanding about the extent of the analysis required for step one, and certainly whether, you know, if it's not completed, what does that mean? And that's definitely an area that
we appreciate. I know you have about 7 minutes. I know the court is interested in this issue on the autopsy report, the testimony, the hearsay portion. Is it a Crawford violation? If so, is there a plain error in this case?
The first thing I would note about that issue is that the defense did not object to the testimony of Dr. Olson either prior to trial, she was a noticed witness, or during trial. The other thing I would say is, in terms of autopsy reports and whether or not they're business records, or you have to have the actual doctor who performed the autopsy, that's pretty much like imposing a statute of limitations on murder. This was a cold case. This case happened in the 80s, and we tried it, you know, in the 2000s. A lot of times, we will be able to, I have another case now that's pending that's 30 years old. The doctor who performed the autopsy is still alive, but it's not, you know, not in good health and may not be alive at the time of trial. So if you don't view autopsy reports differently or as business records, you know, then you are pretty much saying that you can't go forward on certain murder cases.
Ms. Weckerly, we do have a problem because these are made with the purpose of the homicide, quote, going to trial. And I know there's a distinction in terms of the doctor testifying as to they reviewed the information and they make their individual findings, opposed to, and I'll use the term, vouching for or repeating what the original finder made. There's a distinction, and I guess that's what comes into play. Because reading through this, the secondary doctor did say she examined, and she did make some findings, but in other cases, she just parroted what was given originally, and when traversed on cross, she couldn't explain why. She couldn't, in one case, well, there were no photos or there were other things.
Right.
Why should we accept this other testimony. I mean, we're trying to come under the business records, but based upon the Supreme Court, it's really not, we have a problem with the confrontation issue.
And I agree with you. I think the distinction is similar to the Vega case where if she does an independent review and testifies independently, I mean, she's a pathologist. She isn't someone who we just got up there to parrot back what was in the report. She certainly has her own understanding of it. And we often have defense experts or defense doctors testify to dispute our autopsy findings. So certainly these are the types of experts, doctors who can review the reports of others and then make an independent determination and testify to it. And I believe that's what occurred in this case with Dr. Olson. As far as like whether there was prejudice in this case, I don't think anyone who looked at a photograph of this victim would have much of a question about what the cause of death was.
Well, let's talk about the one count that seems to be the issue, and that is the anal penetration and what independent testimony we do have or independent findings of our second doctor.
Well, in the autopsy report, there were no findings of any damage anally. There was bruising vaginally. But the defendant himself told the police that he anally raped the victim after he hit her with a hammer. So the jury knew that occurred after she was struck. And there's...
But how do we deal with the corpus delicti? What is our independence to his statement? Don't we have to have some kind of collaboration?
Yes, and the collaboration would be the DNA, that there was sperm inside.
But that wasn't in the... that might have been on the first count with the vaginal penetration, but not on the anal.
Right, but there's
no evidence to that effect. Is that right?
Well, I mean, there was, you know, there was fecal matter that came out of her after...
there was also indications and testimony that can happen upon death.
That can happen just naturally.
So that's the big concern I had was the corpus delicti. How was that argued? How was it presented? Was it presented?
It was
and,
not.
And should that come into play in our plain error analysis if we agree that there's a Crawford violation here?
The corpus delicti issue wasn't raised at trial or in the briefing, as far as I'm aware. I didn't see that.
Not directly that way, but they did talk in terms of substantial evidence as to the issue.
As to the issue? Well, they didn't argue, though, respectfully, they didn't argue that there wasn't vaginal or anal penetration. They argued that the sex was consensual. And I, in my review of the evidence, that is hard to understand. This woman had her clothes cut off her clothes were had damage to them from the hammer. She was dragged from her kitchen through her living room into her bedroom.
We understand the gore part of it.
Okay.
But we're talking about the specifics. So that's a concern we have because we look at the medical findings and we look at some discrepancies, and so that's why we ask the questions for your position.
And to answer your question and sort of Justice Douglas' question at the same time, when you have, you know, the corpus delicti rule doesn't necessarily, I don't know that it's that broad with when you have like a sexual assault homicide. I think there's some case law that discusses from other jurisdictions, admittedly, from other jurisdictions that discuss that is to be narrowly applied in the case of sexual assault murders. And so when you have a statement like we had from Mr. Connor, that could be enough to substantiate it coupled with how the victim
was. Well, given Mr. Brooks' theory of the crime, you arguing corpus delicti as to anal penetration would be a waste of time.
Yes, it certainly would. If that concludes the Crawford issue, I would just, on the mitigation and moral culpability instruction, I know I'm running out of time. I listened to the arguments previously by this court in Watson, and I would just say that in sentencing, moral culpability is always the factor. We shouldn't be basing decisions, especially the death penalty, on whether someone's good-looking or whether someone's tall or short or male.
But isn't aggravating and mitigating circumstances what that is all about? Not moral culpability.
No, I disagree with you respectfully. The Supreme Court, starting in Penry...
Go ahead and finish your thought.
Starting in the Penry case where they talked about mental retardation and following up in California v. Brown and also in Lockhart versus Ohio, all of those cases don't explicitly list that instruction, but in every one of those cases, they talk about the capital punishment being imposed based on moral culpability. And that is what sentencing is. It's not some arbitrary factor. And if you don't tie it to something, if you don't tie it to moral culpability, you will have inconsistent, arbitrary, capricious imposition of the most weighty sentence there is. I disagree with you on that.
As an accepted instruction, though, where is the basis for it? It was Justice Cherry asked earlier.
Yes.
And if it's as significant and as compelling as you say, where is it supported anywhere in the country?
I ran that wording in Westlaw, and that instruction is used in almost every death penalty state. That
it's specific instruction?
Yes, tying it to moral culpability. I think the basis for it, when I looked it up further, is in the Penry United States Supreme Court case, in California v. Brown, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, and in Lockhart, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, and Eddings.
So Nevada is an outlier in the sense that we include that as part of the jury instruction. Apparently it is practiced to include that as part of the jury instruction.
And in fact, I think that is the definition of mitigation in Black's Law Dictionary as well.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Wackerly, very much. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Brooks, you have about six. Let's round it off to 7 minutes even, since we had some additional questions.
If you could address this last issue first, I'd appreciate it.
Well, let me say it's a surprise to me what Ms. Wackerly just said. I will certainly try to check it out. But
based upon what you told us a little earlier, I'm surprised too.
Yeah. Let me say this. There's no doubt about it. When the U.S. Supreme Court has rejected that nexus requirement, and Ms. Wackerly obviously would like to have mitigators tied to culpability, moral culpability, but the fact is a mitigating circumstance can be anything, and it doesn't have to be limited by moral culpability. And that's the way our system works. Our system works with a presumption that if there's any reason to save a person's life, we should be able to do it for any reason.
Well, the statute clearly says any other mitigating circumstance.
That's correct.
Mr. Brooks, that's the end of that sentence, as determined by the jurors, not the defense attorneys.
That's true.
And not
the
prosecutors.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct, Mr. Brooks. I'd like to dispute several things that Ms. Wackerly said, just to clean up the record here. She mentions that Mr. Anderson was nodding his head and answering for other jurors. He was not answering out loud for other jurors. He was simply mouthing answers to himself, which I think I do that all the time as well. She compared what we did in terms of objecting to the exclusion of certain jurors who simply could not vote for life with what they did with the death penalty. Well, part of the difference is our people said we can't consider life in prison. With her jurors, Anderson and Clark, they said, yes, we can consider death, and they were very clear about it. I think they were very good on that particular issue. With regards to a pattern, I have to say, I think the record was absolutely sufficient when she objected on Batson and said they used 6 out of 9 peremptory challenges. That is clearly a pattern, and there's no doubt but that a pattern can give rise to a Batson violation. It's not required. One Batson violation is sufficient for reversal, but the fact that you have any pattern allows us to go and have this inquiry. Also,
what was the final composition of the jury racially?
I don't know, but there was at least one black on the jury. But I will say, case law is very clear. That is not an determining factor.
I understand that, but she didn't know when the defendant did.
There was a black on the jury. She also mentions, as far as the autopsy report, she says that there was vaginal bruising. That is not what Mr. Clark said in his autopsy report. He did not say he saw bruising. He said that there was possible bruising.
Were there photographs that could have been independently reviewed that indicated bruising?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if they took a picture of that or not.
So you don't know.
Obviously, obviously, the person they presented did not examine the body. Obviously, bruising, vaginal bruising, is completely consistent with consensual or non-consensual sex. Going back to the issue of Batson and what should be done, you know, historically, the objection that was made historically here in our courts was simply objection Batson, and then required the state to give a race-neutral reason. The Missouri Supreme Court, State v. Antwine, said that the race-neutral reason provided by the state remains the essential point of examining whether we have Batson violations. And I think if we start cutting things off before that, I think we're going to have real difficulty with this issue.
Well, that means you can never have a Batson challenge as the first minority juror. You have to wait to see what happens.
It's very confusing. If, for example, I've got to have a pattern, for example, to make the objection, am I going to wait until a pattern exists? And by that point, some of these jurors may already be gone. I think the only way to do it is simply to, once we have a Batson objection, and as long as there's nothing in the record that clearly shows why they're being excused, to initiate the Batson process. And we certainly should initiate the process when there's any pattern. By the way, Justice Cherry, in my career, I have seen exactly one judge, Judge Guy, grant a Batson objection in trial. So, if the court has nothing else.
Mr. Brooks, do we even get to corpus delicti in terms of how the defense is raised for Mr. Connor?
First of all, I apologize. The corpus delicti issue, I think, is essential in analyzing the first sexual assault, the vaginal sexual assault in this case. We're conceding it was a murder. We think second-degree murder. Obviously, the evidence on the anal intercourse is stronger than vaginal intercourse. But there is simply no evidence in the record that the vaginal intercourse was not consensual, except for the statement by the autopsy report that it was probable rape.
How can you say that when you look at the crime scene and what's indicated in the crime scene with the ripped off clothes? Why isn't that something valid to consider?
Because it's obvious what happened. We have an extremely drunk person with a .26 alcohol level. She goes back to her apartment with Charles Connor. They have consensual sex. Then he wants to have anal sex. She doesn't want to. He kills her with the hammer, and now she's rendered completely unable to resist. He cuts off her clothing, and he shaves her pubic hair, and then he has anal sex with her. The first sex, there's a complete difference here between the first sex, which I think was probably consensual, and obviously we'll never know for sure.
But the jury determined that it wasn't.
But
you've got to evaluate everything you're telling us.
Well, the evidence is completely consistent with consensual sex as far as the vaginal sex.
But where do you get that?
Okay, very simply. There is... We know, here are the elements we have to consider. She was extremely drunk. A witness testified that she loved the law with several men. We don't know what happened there. We know that she winds up back at the apartment of Charles Connor. We know there is vaginal intercourse. We know there is anal intercourse. We know that he kills her. We also know that at some point he cuts her clothing off. And we also know he shaves her pubic hair. Now, what is the most sensible and likely story here? I think it's clear that these two people likely had consensual sex. There's nothing contradicting that as far as vaginal sex. The only evidence that suggests some change is his statement to the police, where he says, I hit her with the hammer before I had anal sex with her. So, I guess the most likely thing here, but I wasn't there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Thank you, Ms. Weckerly, for both your excellent briefs and argument. The case will stand submitted, and we will be in recess to 2 o'clock this afternoon for our next case.
All right.